Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and the nature of consciousness. For more information about our organization and the myriad of resources and support that we offer, please visit towardthelight.org and visit our media website, towardthelight.info. A quick announcement, next Saturday, 26th April, we've got our Light on the Water near-death experience support and interest group meeting via teleconference. It will be from 9 to 11 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, and anyone who can ring a U.S. telephone number is welcome to ring in and participate. Again, the meeting is next Saturday, 26th April, from 9 to 11 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. For more information about that, please visit towardthelight.org. Scroll down on the index page, and you will see the call-in number and the information about the Light on the Water meeting. This week, I'm very pleased to have someone who is the author of a very profound book entitled Souls Don't Lie, and Indeed They Do Not. This is about a true-to-life, past-life experience that is quite compelling and powerful indeed. Let us welcome to Toward the Light, Jenny Smedley. Hello, Jenny.
Hello, Julia. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show, and as I've been sharing with you via email, we certainly have discovered that we've had a lot in common. And,
we certainly have, yes.
And we've actually been in the same places and connected to the same people unbeknownst to each other during the time. So,
absolutely. I mean, I think I live now not far from where you lived here, and
yes.
We've been to Nashville as well when you were there. Only we didn't know you were there.
Exactly, and this is what's so stunning, and I've really got to say to our listeners that as a result of doing this radio show, more special and indeed special kindred spirits have been brought to me. So it's like the show has been used to bring family members back into my life. So I'm very, very pleased and honored and excited about this. So why don't we start about, talking about the events that led up to the powerful writing of this book. And I know you were dealing with depression and just kind of lost and not knowing what your life was going to do with you next. So go ahead and tell our listeners about some of the events that led to the writing of this profound book.
Okay. I had never really given past lives much thought, not seriously. I was brought up a Catholic, and the Christian Church doesn't encourage a belief in past lives, so I was never told anything about it. Obviously, I'd heard a bit about it. I got to that stage in my life where I think so many people, I mean, I have so many people writing to me now who are at this stage where they're kind of middle-aged, and they're suddenly wanting to know what they're here for. They suddenly find that nothing much has any meaning. They start to get depressed. They can't see much future. They think there's something missing out in their lives, but they just can't figure out what it is. And like them, I tried many directions, and like most people, I didn't really have anything to be depressed about. I had and have still got the one most wonderful husband. We've been married 39 years this year, believe it or not.
Oh, lovely. And he's a soulmate too, actually, isn't he?
Yes. Oh, definitely, yes, absolutely. This was the weird thing about my experience, which I'll come back to in a minute. But basically, I believe that if we don't figure out for ourselves what we're here for, then we get pushed and nudged along the way, and sometimes quite uncomfortably, because our what I call past life angels now are trying to wake us up to what we came here to do. You know, it's time to do it, so wake up and do it. And if we don't, then we feel very lost, and we do think that something's missing. And I was at that stage where I'd been pushed right to the very bottom of the pit, I wasn't quite suicidal, but I was very close to it. It was only really the love of my husband and knowing what it would have done to him that stopped me just leaving this world, because I didn't think it had anything for me. I was very overweight, and that didn't help. You know, you eat to cheer yourself up, and then you get fed up because you've eaten. And so there I was sitting there one afternoon, and it was just like any other day, except suddenly I had this feeling, I think it was intuition finally kicking in, that something was about to happen, something absolutely monumental. I'd heard other people say, oh, you know, someone's life changed in a second, but that all sounds very melodramatic and you don't really believe it's true. But that was actually what happened. I sat there quivering, waiting for this message to come in that I knew was going to come in, and suddenly it did, and it said, turn on the television.
Well, right before that, actually, weren't you sitting looking at a bottle of pills that was sitting on your coffee table, and then you knocked them off and said no?
I'd done that several times. I'd really, really thought, you know, there isn't any point. I don't think, I have to be perfectly honest, I don't think I would really have taken them. But it's kind of like a smoker who's given up smoking. There's a certain comfort from still having some cigarettes there. If you really need them. And I think that's what the pills were about, really. But I suddenly felt very defiant, and I thought, no, I'm not going to do this. And so that was when this message just popped into my head to turn the TV on. It was like almost like a reward, you know, for fighting. And I put the TV on, and there was this man's face there, and he was talking and smiling, and I'd never seen him before. There wasn't physical attraction. It wasn't like that. Like I've explained, my husband is the most amazing, wonderful man in the whole world to me, and I wouldn't change him for anybody. So it wasn't like that. But just in that very second, totally amazingly, this depression went away. It was like all the lights came on, the clouds lifted, the weight lifted. All the cliches are there, and the most amazing thing was that I knew that I had literally changed. It was like a switch clicking on, and I was never, ever going to go back to that person again. That was it. That part of my life was over. And I was absolutely bemused by all this. I couldn't think what on earth was going on. And, in fact, it took me probably another 6 months before I had an inkling of what exactly was going on. In the meantime, I started to lose weight. I'd gone up to about 13 stone.
Ooh.
And I started to lose. I'm sorry, I don't know what that is in pounds for your listeners over there, but I shed about 45 pounds, in fact, which I needed to. Mm-hmm. And it was so easy. Whereas before, it was a real struggle to lose weight. It was so easy. I also started writing songs. And amazingly enough, within a few months, one of them won a silver disc. Which is, you know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. You
let me ask you, had you ever written songs before, or was this new?
No, totally new.
Wow, okay. So when you saw that face on the telly, you actually experienced a recognition.
Well, that's what it turned out to be. Eventually, I was talking to a lady who was using crystals to diagnose problems with my horse's back, which I found fascinating, and I thought I'd ask her about this strange psychic connection I seem to have with this man on the other side of the world.
Yes.
Because I better tell the listeners that it in fact turned out to be Garth Brooks, the country music singer. I wasn't a country music fan at all.
Oh, me neither, I've got to admit.
No,
living in Nashville.
You know, over in this country, country music is not popular.
Right.
And Garth Brooks is unheard of. And anyway, this lady, I said to her, how can I have a connection with somebody on the other side of the world? And she said, of course you can. And I said, but I never met him. And she said, not in this life. And every time I say that, and I've got, now I get goosebumps, because that's what happened at that moment. Again, it was like a light going on. And I knew without any more thought that that was the answer. It just felt right. It really felt right. Anyway, I went for regression under hypnosis, and sure enough, that was the case. I had known this person before in a past life. Of course, since then, this has happened to me many times. Many times I've now recognized people, or they've recognized me, whether it be face-to-face or on the internet. You know, you just know, and you start talking, and you have experiences that tally up, you know.
Exactly, and exactly.
Yeah, you start to understand that we go round and round interacting with the same people over and over again. And this, as well as the fact that I wrote this all down as a journal, and then, of course, had to go across to America, which wasn't easy as I'm terrified of flying.
That was profound as well, reading about that. Let me back up, if you didn't mind, a little bit. What was the details in your book were so precise and clear and consistent. Mm. And if you don't mind me asking, did you get all of this from the past life regressions, and how did those come about? And I certainly, I certainly understand, because in America it was Dr. Brian Weiss who actually stumbled upon this work himself. He had been a Freudian psychiatrist.
Quite by accident, really.
Yes. Exactly. You know about his story, do you?
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, thanks to him, a lot of other practitioners have become past life regressionists. And the details that come forth are quite stunning indeed. So I was wondering if, as a result of, you know, I don't know how many sessions you had, and perhaps that's not even important, but you know, you were able to remember and glean all of those intricate details and then write about them. How did that all come about, if you don't mind me asking?
Not at all. There was a myriad of ways, actually. Mostly it was past life regression. I had several sessions with several different therapists, because it's always useful to go to different therapists who don't know anything about your story to find out more about it. I also learned the technique of self-hypnosis, especially with the additional help of crystals, to delve into my own subconscious, which was quite useful. I had some incredible experiences like that. Some of it was done, I got automatic writing through while I was watching the TV, not even looking at what I was writing. My husband used to watch me, and we were both amazed to see what I'd written afterwards. And also, I have encountered many of the people from the story are, you know, again in the world with us now. For instance, anybody who reads it, and I know you have, Juliet, Nancy the cook,
yes,
came back to me. She came back to me in this lifetime. Sadly, she died a couple of months ago, and I felt once again like I'd lost a mother. But she was an amazing, amazing woman, and she was totally, totally skeptical when I first went to her with the story. And I went to her because she was the editor of a country music magazine, and I wanted her take on it.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
I know. And she was, you know, you're led, aren't you? And she was completely skeptical at first, and then she was kind of concerned about lawsuits and things like that. But suddenly she started to get these flashbacks, and I was in Ireland once, and she phoned me in Ireland. She said, "Jenny, I've just seen Ryan," who, of course, Garth Brooks was in that lifetime. Mm. And as Nancy, she had had a vision of crossing a stream over stepping stones with him walking behind her, saying, "Hurry up, Nancy, hurry up," you know. And she turned around and seen him laughing, and she was so amazed that she totally, straight away, became a convert and was my defender and helper and friend after that for always. And
is
then,
she in America? Or
she was in England. In fact, she lives in Hampshire. She lives in Hampshire, or lived in Hampshire, where Ryan and Madeline lived. And then there was the lady who wrote to me from America, and she lives in Seattle. And she had for quite a few years been thought totally bonkers by her family, because she had this obsession about changing photographs of Garth Brooks. She would, her daughter was a fan, and she'd go in her daughter's bedroom and scribble all over a poster, adding long hair and stuff to the pictures of Garth. Garth Brooks, and she would tell her family that she had a dream about this happening with her Irish son, and you know, they really did think she totally lost it. And then she found my book, and she was able to go to them and to her family and open the pages and say, look, that story I told you about. Remember I said this happened with my son? Well, there he is. Garth Brooks was Ryan, and he was my son in a past life. And that's why I changed the photograph. And when the picture of, I don't know if you've heard of when Garth Brooks did Chris Gaines.
You know, I've got to admit my ignorance. I have, that I am aware of, I've not even heard any of his CDs. Now, whilst I was living in Nashville, as I shared with you, I was involved with people in his circle, and the choir that I was in, Nashville and Harmony, we performed at the Ryman Auditorium, which is the most coveted stage in Nashville, and we sang God's song, We Shall Be Free.
Yeah.
And I've only heard our arrangement of that song, so I have to admit my ignorance. I've really not heard Garth.
It's a great song.
Yeah.
But yeah, so these people were able to fill in some gaps. The lady in Seattle. Oh, one thing I must tell you, because I found this absolutely incredible. I said to her, I'm not testing you, because, you know, you're telling me this and I believe you, but just out of interest, do you remember your son Ryan in that lifetime having a birthmark? And she described this birthmark to me. She described where it was, and she described the color of it, the shape of it, the size of it, the texture of it, absolutely accurately, because I'd already written it all down as a control and shown it to somebody else. And when I said to her, I said, that's absolutely incredible. That is identical to the birthmark he had. And she said, well, what's even more remarkable is I described it to you looking in a mirror, because I have it. And she had the exact same birthmark which she just described to me.
Wow. Wow. Now, let's share a little bit of the story of yours and Garth's past life that we're talking about. This is so compelling.
It's a long story. It gets ever so complicated. It's hard for me sometimes to remember what I've said already. But, yes, Ryan and Madeline. Madeline was a fairly aristocratic young lady of French Catholic descent who lived in Hampshire in the village of Hambledon. And her father had remarried when Madeline's mother had died to a rather money-grabbing, rather nasty woman called Margaret. And things were not very happy. And at the same time, over in Ireland, the Earl of Kildare had slept with who turned out to be Ryan's mother, although she was married to somebody else and had children by the somebody else as well. So she gave birth to an illegitimate son. And these are things I didn't understand in the beginning. These are things that have been found out from other people who were there at the time, like, for instance, Ryan's Irish half-brother. He has come forward and filled in more gaps. But basically, I can sort of tell it now, you know, with hindsight of everything we found out. So this lady, Catelyn, she gave birth to an illegitimate son. And in those times, even an illegitimate son could claim the earldom. Now, this didn't go down too well with the legitimate son, who was Ryan's half-brother, and he, in fact, drove Ryan out of Ireland, and he went across the sea, and after a series of mishaps and adventures, he and Madeline met, and they fell in love. Now, the irony of this story is that Ryan had truly blue blood in his veins, but because he never told anybody about it, Madeline's stepmother, Margaret, refused to accept him. Even when they secretly got married, she still refused to accept him. And the irony is, if only she'd known, she would have probably welcomed him with open arms, because that was what she wanted, was aristocratic blood in the family. But
and
as
she
it
regarded
was,
him just as a commoner, right?
That's right, very much
yeah.
so.
Mm.
She treated him extremely badly and tried everything she could think of to get rid of him. And eventually, she had him abducted and taken off to fight against Scotland. Now, I knew, I discovered that he was killed by what I thought at the time were Scottish soldiers. But it wasn't until much later, when the brother came forward to tell his side of the story, that I came to understand that it was actually the brother, the Irish brother, who came over from Ireland. But actually,
and that
because
that was Keith, whom you met at
that was Goss. Keith, yes.
Yeah,
yes, you see, these circles, Julia, these circles just go round and round, don't they?
Yes, I do.
I mean, I was endeavouring to meet Garth because I wanted to tell him about this. I thought he might find it interesting. Plus, I needed to close the circle for Madeline and for Ryan, who were separated in that lifetime. She never knew what happened to him. And so my depression was... It was half grief of not knowing what had become of this man.
Yes,
and it was also because I was looking for my pathway in this life. So there was two aspects to the depression. And, so I was endeavouring to meet him. And so during my endeavours, I actually ended up getting the ticket that Keith's son didn't want for the concert in Ireland, flying over there with Keith and his wife, and spending the night with them in their hotel room. It's just rather bizarre.
Was it Keith's wife who was your friend, or were they both friends of yours?
I'd never met either of them before in my life.
Oh, you hadn't done?
No.
So how did you connect?
This was to do with dear Nancy, who in this life was called Sue. And Sue had introduced me to another lady who was a country music journalist called Hannah Valise. And when Hannah knew I was looking for a ticket for the concert, which were all sold out, she phoned me up and she said, a friend of mine has got a ticket because their son doesn't want to go. So you can have that ticket if you like. But it means sharing a hotel room with these people you've never met before in your life.
Wow.
But of course, wow. Keith and I clicked instantly, and he instantly said to me, I believe your story. I know your story. But at the time, he didn't know why he knew it. He didn't know who he was in that lifetime. Yeah, so it was quite strange because everybody else at the concert was really, really happy. And I was incredibly upset because I could see straight away from the distance that we were that I wasn't going to get to talk to Garth or even get anywhere near him, in fact. And Keith wanted to know what was wrong, why I wasn't enjoying it, and so I told him. I told him the whole story. And, you know, he just straight away accepted it completely. And it wasn't until, really, a couple of years later that he started to have dreams, and his memories of having been Ryan's half-brother and having killed him came back to him. And he was terribly, terribly upset and actually sobbed his heart out when he told me. But, you know, he got over it because you need to let these things out sometimes. Because guilt from past lives is totally purposeless and unnecessary because you're no longer that person.
Well, yes, and I think guilt anyway is pointless. And I even encourage people to boldly write out the word guilt and then cross it out, you know, because there's really no place for that. And it's so debilitating indeed. And I just think that this is so profound that, you know, that you connected with Keith. And I think it's a wonderful thing that he actually was able to grieve, because that was a tremendous release and closure for him as well.
And that's right. I mean, his life has changed enormously since then. He's actually written a musical about Valentino, which is debuting in November. And although he's always been a singer and a musician, he never would have dreamed of actually writing a musical and having it appear on the stage.
Wow.
It's incredible. I mean, it's like me, you know, the other part of my story, as I said, or the other part of my depression was that I needed to know what my master plan was. And I didn't. I didn't know what I was here for. And once I started coming out with my story, which a lot of people were surprised that I did that, because, you know, obviously some people's reactions are not good to that kind of thing. But I'm a firm believer, you know, if you're standing in your own light, if you're standing in what you know is the truth, nobody can really touch you.
Exactly.
And, you know, by then I'd found the house where they lived, I'd found the church where they were married, and been able to point out enough things that I couldn't possibly have known to convince myself anyway that it was all true. And I was on a train going to do a television program about reincarnation and the Christian church and why it wasn't accepted. And I was just to put my side of the story, you know. And I was quite nervous about this program because I was going up against a regular presenter on the program, a vicar's wife. And because she was a regular on there every week, you know, I knew it was going to be quite difficult. But it was a live program, and I never mind live programs because, you know, they can't change what you said.
Exactly.
And,
including
now. Yeah, that's right. So I was on the train, and of all places to have one, I had an angelic encounter on the train, and I had this incredible golden being appear to me, and you know all about that sort of thing.
Oh yes, oh yes.
And that feeling of total rapture, that's the only word I can think of for it, is rapture, being in the presence of an angel. And this angel showed me what I was to do, what my purpose in coming here was, and it was to be a spiritual seed planter. My job was just to plant seeds of spirituality in people's hearts. Doesn't matter what it's about, it doesn't have to be past lives, just so that people start to question our modern values.
And that's so vitally important, actually, and I've got to say, when I was reading your book, I was so animated with joy and gratitude because, you know, first of all, I really want to acknowledge and praise you for your tremendous courage.
Didn't have a choice. Didn't have a choice.
Isn't that the truth, too, really? You know, when spirit catapults you onto a path.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got to be true to soul, you know.
Yes.
This is... it's something that there's no turning back. You've just got to do it come what may. But it's amazing. It's beautiful. All of the positive response that you've gained. And I think the very few possibly not positive are just coming from ignorance. And they too will ultimately find out the truth.
And fear. A lot of people are afraid.
Exactly.
Of this kind of thing. That's definitely true.
I think part of that could be the fact that it, you know, it pushes you to take responsibility for who you are and how you think, how you behave, and all of that. It's and I've never resonated with the idea.
There's an amazing
Go ahead.
There's an amazing American comedy show called My Name Is Earl. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No, I don't watch television, to be honest.
I tell you though, the spiritual world are getting in on everything nowadays. They really are. Some of the television programs that are coming out are amazing. I mean, this one is a comedy show, basically. But this guy, he got a winning lottery ticket, or he stole it, and immediately he got hit by a truck. And while he was in hospital, he decided that this was karma getting him back for stealing the lottery ticket, and he decided to make a list of everything bad he'd ever done in his life and spend the rest of his life putting those things right. So although it's a comedy show, it has a really good message behind it, you know. And I just think it's brilliant, the balance, you know, because karma is all about balance, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I think still too many people are misinterpreting exactly what karma is, for example.
Yes.
You know, someone is ill or someone is struggling, some people will make judgments that,
you've done
something bad in a past life. Not necessarily so.
No.
And it's much more intricate and complex than that. But, you know, it's very interesting reading in the book and reading about Margaret. I mean, my heart was actually racing because there's so many things that are familiar, the things that have happened in my own life, and I just thought, oh, bless this lady, referring to you, for writing about this and putting it out there into the world. And then, you start to talking about how you actually did connect with God. So let's get into this, because again, this is all a meant to be kind of thing, obviously. Mm. Despite your fears of flying and all of that, you made it to Nashville. So
I did.
Why don't you tell us a bit about the amazing journey you had gone to the concert, obviously. And now let me ask you, because it wasn't entirely clear, and excuse me jumping around a little bit here, were you up in a balcony or something, and that's why you couldn't really see him too easily?
Yes.
At the concert?
Yes, up in the gods, as they call it, yes.
Yes,
that's
okay.
Right. And no way down at all. You know, you had to go out the back way to get downstairs. There was no way of getting down to the stage area at all.
But there was actually a point where you did establish eye contact with him. Am I correct about that?
That's right. That's right. It was very strange because there's a song of his, which you won't know, of course, called The Dance, which he didn't write, but it's sort of become his signature tune.
Mm.
And it's all about I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance. So he's saying, you know, I wouldn't have given up the dance even if I'd known that the pain was coming. It's a very, very deep song. It's a great song. And it's very much a Ryan song, because he knew, it transpires now, because of conversations he had with people at the time, that he knew, he always knew that he was going to end up dead because of his association with Madeline. He always knew that was going to happen, but he chose to stay because he couldn't bear to miss the dance with
yes.
her. And the opening bars of this song came on, and like always, everybody started singing the words. You know what it's like at one of these huge open-air concerts. Everybody started singing the words, and he had walked out into the crowd at the bottom and climbed up on this little podium. And as he turned round singing, he was like turning round and round, and I was looking down, and he suddenly looked up, and he froze, just staring upwards where I was staring downwards. And at that moment, the whole audience, the whole crowd stopped singing. And it was totally silent except for his voice. And it was just like one of those moments, you know, when I met him, when I finally did meet him, that was repeated. It was almost like, you know, I can sometimes look at people now and their clothes change and I can see their past life all around them.
Mm.
And that was almost really the first time it happened. It was almost as if his clothes changed. It was almost as if for a few seconds he became Ryan. And everybody's hands dropped. And all around me, everybody's hands dropped and they all went silent. Just for about 2 minutes. And then just like that, it all started up again. It was very, very strange.
One thing I remember that you wrote about in the book, I'm going to ask the question, but then I want to take this caller.
Okay.
You were dealing with the depression, and you'd gone into a mall. Hang in there, caller.
Oh, yeah.
We'll get to you in a second. You were very distraught as you were walking around in the mall, and you had a song.
Mm-hmm. That was the dance. Yeah,
and
that
ended up being the dance. So it was already sort of working its way into your being.
Mm.
And then it was after that that you had the experience with the voice said, turn on the telly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very profound. All right, who's our caller? You are on the air.
Hello, my name is Elaine.
Hello, Elaine.
Yes, I'd like to ask about my mother who has passed on. If she has any messages for me, is she trying to communicate with me?
Well, I'm really certain that she is, and it's always important to pay attention to that. I actually addressed that in my blog most recently, a couple of articles that I just put up on my blog, Into Light, which you might appreciate reading.
What is the name of the blog?
it's N2 light, and if you go to letter N, number 2, and then the word light,
N2light.blogspot.com.
And that gives a lot of information about this very thing that you are asking.
N2light.blogspot.com, right?
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Thanks.
And thank you so very much for calling.
Can you tell me if she has any messages for me?
Well, actually, we're talking about other things right now, so this isn't really appropriate for this particular time, but we can talk about this some other time.
Okay, thank you. And can you tell me what you're talking about now? Because I don't have a computer to listen, and I'm very, you know, curious. You know, I'm very interested.
Well, actually, we do have to go resume with the program. But you're welcome to call me, and you can leave a message with Dawn at BBS, and I'm happy to connect with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, love. Blessings to you.
Thank you. Same to you.
Okay. These are actually very good questions.
Yeah, my heart goes out to people. I lost my mum. I know what it's like.
Oh,
I was getting, actually, while that lady was talking, I was getting a very strong picture of a kitten. So perhaps when she calls you again, ask her if she's just got a kitten, a black and white kitten.
I was seeing something similar to that, so that's interesting. When you said kitten, I saw black and white and maybe a little bit of grey in there. And
so
you
I think that'll prove to her that her mum's still watching her.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm a widow myself, and so And I'm constantly communicating with people. In fact, I've had a lot of experiences in Nashville. Talk about people that some people know. Chet Atkins.
Oh, yes.
I was at his funeral at the Ryman in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who's close to me did a lot of work with Ryan. Actually, a few people I know did a lot of work with Chet. Here I said Ryan. Mm-hmm. Okay. Hello. Garth Ryan. thank you so much. And I think it was 2 or 3 days after Chet's funeral. I felt like it was a very crowded house in my house in Nashville. And all of a sudden, I was aware of Chet. Sometimes I just called him Uncle Chet to be affectionate. And and then I was aware of my friend too. And we were all nattering away. And then a friend came to visit me, and we were in the sitting room, and all of a sudden my stereo system went on, and I knew that it was Chet, because he could be a bit of a prankster, truth be told. So sometimes I will still get Chet, and this is just so commonplace with me to pick up on people who have transitioned, and it's really not unusual at all. But
I think you've got a lot of courage to do that. I only occasionally get messages from passed over spirits, and it always terrifies me because there's such a huge responsibility goes with it, isn't there?
There is.
You hold people's peace of mind in your hand, don't you?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I also try to give people the tools for being able to perceive the presence of their loved one, like this lady who just asked about her mum.
Oh, excellent.
You know, because there are so many ways. I mean, just, you know, for example, all of the things that led up to you connecting with God, there's all of these synchronistic events that you can't deny that take place and that, you know, that are validating, and it's very special, and they can be very simple, like feeling a touch on the face or a butterfly going past or something in the clouds. About 3 weeks ago, when my daughter was visiting me, we were taking a walk, and I put this in the newsletter too, and she said, "Mom, look up." She counted 11 hawks.
Yes, I saw that.
Circling round about.
Yes.
And hawks are messengers. So I thought, all right, you know, pay attention, because there's a lot going on. So my radar is on high at this moment. I'm really paying attention to any little thing that may come about, because there's so many answers that come, even in something so unlikely, like a voice that says, "Switch on the television."
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
You've got to listen to that, and that's what I'm always
Yeah, because I could have missed that. The moment would have passed. And because he's not on TV over here very often, I can tell you, that moment would have passed, you know, and I would never have seen him. It was,
so yeah, that was really, really profound, and that led to you, you know, having these past life regressions that were really validating. And then what were the events that actually led to you meeting God? Because you went to the concert, and really the most profound thing that happened was that you weren't able to meet him, but you connected with Keith.
Mm.
And then you knew that still something had to occur. So what happened? What happened after that?
Well, I felt that I needed to touch his hand, because that was the last touch that he and Madeline had, that Ryan and Madeline had, and I felt that would kind of, you know, rejoin or break the circle, whichever way you want to look at it. It would complete the circle, if you like.
Mm.
And but, you know, how was I to do that? You said about me being brave. I think foolhardy is probably more like it. Because, I mean, I had never, ever been on a plane. By this time, I was 49, and I'd never, ever been on a plane. And my husband would have bet anybody thousands of pounds that I never, ever would. It was total, absolute phobia. I used to have nightmares about being on a plane and it crashing and things like that. It was just, there was no way I was going to do it. And yet, I said to him, because when I went to the house where they used to live, I feel, and I feel this happens with a lot of people, I feel that I collected a facet of myself that I'd left there.
Yes,
when I
soul retrieval.
Mm. Yeah. And I felt it was, in part, it was courage, and it was somebody who, unlike me, had no trouble at all saying no, because I have a lot of trouble doing that. And,
yes.
You know, I fetched this part of myself and reabsorbed it. And once I'd done that, I said to my husband, right, we're going to go to America for a holiday. Well, when he got up off the floor and finished laughing, he said, you know, this, you won't, I mean, I wouldn't even go in a travel agent's, because it was something like going near a plane. And, no, I marched him to the travel agent's, and I went in and I booked this holiday, and I couldn't even believe I'd done it. And I can really remember 5 o'clock in the morning driving to the airport, and it was surreal. You know, it was like I'd stepped out of my body and she'd taken over. That's exactly what it was like, because I don't really think that I, as me, could have done it. And got on the plane anyway, and actually had to go on 3 planes to get there.
Right, I remember reading about that.
Mm. And the first one was a propeller plane.
Yes.
we're a bit old-fashioned over here, aren't we?
No, they have them a lot in different places in America, and when I lived in Hawaii, we used a lot of those as well.
Right. At least you can see that the engine's going round, can't you?
Yes. Wow.
Anyway, somehow I survived that, and the jumbo jet over to Detroit, and then the twin engine jet down to Nashville. And as I said, a bit foolhardy, and I thought, I know, I'll go and see his manager. Well,
now
you know,
that's what I think is brave, is approaching his manager. Oh,
why me? It was just like, you know, I just was going to do it. I had no fear. It was, this is what happened, and I'm going to tell them. Because I'd already, you see, I'd already sent a copy of the manuscript to Joan Cook, who was sort of front of house at the time. And Joan is actually an English woman, married to Roger Cook, or used to be married to Roger Cook, a songwriter, and she'd worked there for years. And I sent it to her, and she phoned me up. I couldn't believe it. She phoned me up from the offices of GB Management and said to me that she'd read it, she thought it was wonderful, and that she knew it was true.
Wow.
And she said she knew it was true because, she said, I knew Garth extremely well, the real person behind the phenomena.
Yes.
And I knew him better than some people who'd known him for years. And the only way that, and she said that, you know, Ryan simply was Garth. Anything that Ryan did was exactly what he would have done in the same circumstances. And she said, you know, it has to be true. So I said, oh, well, great, you know, so there's no problem with me publishing the book or anything. Oh, no, she said, I wouldn't have thought so. But then I started to get intimations that his management company weren't best pleased with it. Now, I can understand that, you know. They think there's this completely deranged woman who's trying to make money out of our golden goose.
And, yes.
You know, his fan base is the Bible Belt, and what are they going to think about all this? And,
you got it, exactly.
Yeah, and they got themselves into a bit of a tizzy about it. So I just thought, well, I'm in Nashville. I'll go and see them. So I just turned up, you know. And I think there was a bit of consternation went on, and I got whisked into this conference room, and there was Bob Doyle, Garth's manager, and his attorney. But that should have told me something, shouldn't it? Anyway, I think they were part curious, part terrified, really. They didn't quite really know what I was going to be like. And after a few minutes, they said to me, but you don't seem at all mad. Thank you. Anyway, they finally voiced their fears, and the attorney said, tell me, he said, if Garth were to admit this was all true and that he used to be your husband, would you still consider him to be your husband now? Well, I absolutely fell about laughing. I mean, they obviously thought I was going to claim 400 years alimony or something. And that was my reaction too. I said, yeah, my husband's sitting outside in your car park, and I wouldn't swap him for anybody, however rich. I'm sorry, you know, that's just a really, really silly question.
Very good.
Anyway, after some while, they said to me, okay, we admit it. You are obviously sincere. You haven't made this up. You really truly believe it. You know, basically, there's nothing we can do to stop you, so.
Now, let me ask you, did you tell them that you had been through regression sessions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'd read it. They'd obviously read the book because they knew so much about it. And I said to them, well, you know, have you told Garth about it? And they sort of looked at each other and said, I haven't, have you? And the other one said, no, I haven't. So they hadn't even told him about it. So after all this, you know, there's a thing about, you know, you fire off things and you think you're hitting the bullseye when actually, you know, you're nowhere even near the barn door. And,
right.
And this was the thing with me. For 4 years, I'd thought that he was hearing about it, and he hadn't heard about it at all.
Well,
so I said,
I mean, these people are like 20 feet thick iron doors, you know. Being in the music business, I could tell you some stories.
I think it's a bit sad, you know. I think for all these huge stars, it's a bit sad because they become totally disconnected with the real world, don't they?
They certainly do, and you know, it's actually the ones who surround them who are quite delusional because they start regarding them strictly as commodities, just for sale, rather than human beings with a life and with past lives too, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So. I think, you served as a good wake-up call for them.
I did, actually. I think they were quite shocked. I mean, I have to say, Bob Doyle is a really great man. He's a great guy. He's very nice, very much the gentleman. There were others, whom I'm not going to mention, in the entourage who weren't so pleasant at all, but we won't talk about them.
I can't remember if I met Bob or not.
Well, he actually mortgaged his house to give Garth his first break, you know, because he believed in him so much. I think that kind of shows the sort of man he is, you know.
That was huge,
really,
yes.
Yeah, he really did put his money where his mouth is.
Mm.
But anyway, I said to them, well, can I meet him? And they said, no. And I thought, oh, for goodness, you know, what is wrong with you people? I only want to tell him something, you know, for goodness sake. They were afraid, you see, that he'd say something untoward and that I'd splash it to the papers, and I guess.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, they said, anyway, he's not here. They tried not to smirk. They said, he's not here. He's in Los Angeles, and he won't be back until you've gone.
So I thought, oh, for goodness sake, I've done all that.
They were lying to you. Yes.
They weren't actually. You could think that, but I don't think they were. I think they genuinely didn't know, because when he did come back, it was only for his daughter's birthday party. And, you know, he could have come back without telling them he was coming back. But anyway, the fact was, at that particular time, he wasn't there. He was at an award ceremony in Los Angeles. So we went back to our motel, bit fed up, and we had to go to New York to do some TV, and we came back again to Nashville, and we were about 2 miles from the airport, and I suddenly had this overwhelming sense of knowledge that he was nearby, and I said to my husband, he's here. He's here now. And he said, right, come on, let's go. So I'd actually, my husband's wonderful, isn't he? I mean, he was terrified because, like you, he thought, you know, what is she doing? You know, she's going to get into such trouble in a minute. You know, somebody's going to really upset her because she keeps just going in with her heart on her sleeve. And he was concerned at what Garth's reaction might be because, you know, he knew that he could have quite easily really destroyed me, you know, if he'd really taken it badly.
Let me ask you, was the book actually already written and published then at this point?
Well, it's a bit complicated. The first version was called Ripples, and it was published, and it was paid to be published by another friend of mine from that past life, who was a man in that life called Jared. At the time, I met him in a series of bizarre things happened. He didn't put an advert in a magazine for a lyricist, and yet it went in there, and he wasn't looking for one, and I contacted him, and we started writing songs together, and eventually I showed him the manuscript, and he read it, and he phoned me straight up, and he said, I'm going to give you £10,000 to have this published.
Woof.
And I was like, "What? That's wonderful, but why?" And he said, for love.
Wow.
And I thought, what do you mean? And he's a great guy. He lives in Spain currently. But he did that. And he said to me, I know the story. And at the time, that was as far as we went. But we found out later why. But we probably haven't got time to go into that.
Actually, we've got another hour ahead of us.
Oh, right. Well, maybe we'll come back to that later. But Graham was with us when we went there. To Nashville.
Mm.
There was my husband and I and Graham. And of course, nobody could tell us where Garth's house was. And I actually used a crystal and a map to find it and actually found it, which was like another totally bizarre thing. These bizarre things are like queuing up by now and you kind of start to take them as normal. So anyway, we went to his house, and it was perfectly obvious he was there because as we got out of the car, we could hear him calling his dog. I knew that voice anywhere, even if it was shouting out, Spot! Because that was the name of his dog. Anyway, it transpired later that he'd come home for his daughter's birthday party. And we quickly realised there was a party going on because cars kept arriving and tapping in codes into the computer at the gate, and the gate would open and in they'd go. And eventually Graham stopped went up to one of the cars when she had her window down and said, could she tell Garth we were here from England? I would really much like to have a chat with him if he had time. And she said she would, and she went in, and this party went on, and they played baseball, and we were still waiting outside, and eventually all the guests left again, and it went very quiet, and then Garth came out, and he drove down the drive in a truck, and he came through the gates, and he stopped, and he got out, and he sort of walked halfway across the road towards me, and then he just stopped, and nobody said anything. And it was one of those, like, frozen in time moments, you know. And then I said hello, and he came across, and we clasped hands. And that was like things just went off in my head at that point. I could see Ryan when he died. I could see him laying there. And one of the most poignant things was that his brother took his wedding ring off his finger because it had belonged to his father and it had the Fitzgerald, it was the Fitzgerald seal ring.
Yes.
And he needed that to take over the earldom. And Ryan had used it as his wedding ring and his brother took it off him while he lay there dying, having run him through with a sword. He took the ring off him. And in my mind's eye, I saw my hand reaching down and putting the ring back on his hand. And I do feel that in some way that what I saw was kind of symbolic. But in some way the two souls were reunited. Now, people sometimes question that and they say, well, if you're both back down here, how can your souls be reunited somewhere else? But as I'm sure you know, Juliet, we leave a part of ourselves in spirit all the time.
Absolutely. Not, in fact, most of it is in the spirit world.
That's right. So in the spirit world, those two parts of us were reunited. On this plane, you know, we're not meant to be together on this physical plane. It's purely a spiritual thing. And then, as you can see by the photo on the cover of the book, he was very cuddly. He wanted to hug me. And I told him about the book, and everybody else kind of held their breath, but I didn't, because I just knew he'd be fine with it, and he was. His whole face lit up, and he asked for a copy of it and said, could he have it, could he read it? He wanted to read it. But the only kind of, and everything was absolutely fabulous and fantastic. He went back to the house and brought me presents down, and all kinds of things. It was like he came out of his body. It was like he was somebody else. He became Ryan for that time. There's no shadow of a doubt about it. His eyes changed. And when he was reading the back of the book, he read the back, and then he looked up at me, and I was standing literally inches in front of the book. And he held my eye contact with neither of us blinking. Well, my husband said he counted over 15 before he stopped counting. And you just don't do that, you know, you don't hold eye contact with somebody like that without blinking for no reason for all that time. And I'd love to know what was going through his mind. It seemed to me that he was kind of trying to read my mind, you know.
That is really, really auspicious that that took place. I'm going to do a little station ID here. You're listening to Toward the Light, leading back to the source. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and my special guest this week is Jenny Smedley. We are talking about her books, Souls Don't Lie, about her past life that involved the current-day Garth Brooks. So this is really, really tremendous. Oh, and we should give out your website, jennysmedley.com, jennysmedley.com. Do you have another website as well, Jenny? I believe you do.
Well, I do have a new one, but it takes you to the same address. It's I'm trying to remember it now. It's I think it's pastlifehelp.
That sounds familiar.
.co.uk. I think it's pastlifehelp.co.uk.
Okay,
I've only just bought that new domain,
site.
But it's the same site, yes.
Okay.
JennySmedley.com take you there, yes.
And, of course, you've got your profile page on towardthelight.org.
I have, yes, thank you.
You're so welcome. towardthelight.org/jennysmedley.html. So people can go there and find you, and it's hot-linked to your website. And I've got three of your books on there. I just thought, all right, I'll get this all together. This is very exciting. One thing that I was getting a sense of when you and Garth were in that deep eye contact is that you were really connecting on a soul level, and you were going through the remembering, I would venture to say, and that it really took root in both of you as well. And, you know, that right there is very, very telling because of this recognition that took place.
Mm.
And, you know, everything that you have done everything that you have said has been very consistent. It's been very sound. Plus the fact that you've had all of these experiences kind of out of the blue that has led you to that point. So obviously it was meant to be.
Yes, I mean, some people say, oh, you know, it's a bit strange that it had to be someone really, really famous. You know, it wasn't just Joe Bloggs down the road. But the fact is, they get it the wrong way round. I didn't kind of decide to do it because he's famous. It was because he's famous that I was given the memories in this lifetime, because I'm here to plant seeds. And so, you know, he has a role to play in this, and he's gradually coming to play that role. He's made several songs that are very spiritual, and one, When You Come Back to Me Again, about someone that's died. And it's not when I come to join you, it's when you come back to me, when we meet the circle's end. You know, when we reach the circle's end. And so that sounds very much to me like it's inferring that people live again. But he's also even made quite an amusing song called Cowgirl's Saddle. But it is, you know, that one is just blatantly about past lives. It actually starts off with him talking. And when I was sent this, I didn't know about the song, and you could have knocked me down with a feather, because you hear him say, the next thing I knew was I could see this big white light, and a voice asked me, so Garth, what did you enjoy most about your past life? You know, hearing him say that was just totally bizarre. As I say, it's a comedy song about him talking about coming back as a cowgirl saddle, because his two favourite things were cowgirls and horses. So it's kind of a joke, you know, he comes back as a cowgirl saddle.
Indeed, in Franklin, Tennessee, which is the quaint old town just south of Nashville, and I live there too, it's loaded with horse farms or horse ranches or what have you. And it's really, really beautiful there, and I was telling you about these two people have been on my show, Peter Shockey and his wife, Still Shockey. Mm-hmm. Well, Peter is the film producer who produced Life After Life, based on Raymond Moody's book. And the interesting thing is that his wife, Stowe, and I love them both to bits, she's a singer-songwriter as well. And she initially worked with Garth Brooks.
Garth Brooks, yeah. I knew you were going to say that.
Oh, blimey. Yes, so we were talking about that quite a bit. She would tell me stuff, you know, a lot of which I've just forgotten now.
I'd be interested to hear some of that stuff. That'd be very interesting.
So we should probably all go back to Nashville and have a big tea party and exchange, you know, compare notes.
Yeah. Well, you have to wonder, you know, because one of Garth's best friends is John Travolta. John Travolta is a Scientologist.
Oh, God help us.
But as well as everything else, he obviously believes in reincarnation. So I'd be interested to know whether it's ever been mentioned.
Oh, interesting.
You know, between the two of them.
Yes, and then I was telling you about Pam Lewis, who worked with Garth, and I guess
she doesn't
now.
No.
And she's a fellow near-death experiencer. And funnily enough, you know, even though she never came to my support group meetings when I was in Nashville, every time she did see me, you know, when I was at a concert, you know, we'd cross paths quite a lot in that town.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a small town very quickly. And she would always very lovingly call out, Juliet, it's me, you know, and it's me, Pam, and because she knew that I can't see well, and so she was always kind enough to let me know that she was there, and we were nattering and stuff like that. So, you know, the circle was quite small there, and she could be very warm, and then also just seemingly very distant at other times as well. So it's kind of curious, but, you know,
I think she's been through some tough experiences, probably.
She has done, and I think she's had a lot of issues just dealing with her near-death experience, because
Yes, I'm sure, yeah.
you know, once we've been to something like that, just kind of like the experiences that pushed you onto the path that resulted in the writing of the book, there's no denying certain things and there's no turning back, and you've got to move forward on this path being true to your soul's calling.
Yes.
So, you know, you can't just live a sort of mundane or pretentious life, which unfortunately
no.
a lot of people in Nashville do.
Yeah.
Not meaning to be rude here, but it's true. And another point that I would like to make about all of this is that, you know, just because people become famous in a certain life, that doesn't mean that they're any more special or less human than anybody else. That's
exactly.
just their particular calling in this life, and,
yeah.
and God is just as human as God as he was as Ryan.
Exactly.
This is
what I say to people, you know, who I don't mind skeptics, but cynics, I find a bit annoying, because nobody rushes around trying to convince other people that their beliefs are rubbish, but for some reason past lives always seem to attract that kind of person. But I say to them, you know, either you believe in past lives or you don't. If you don't, that's fair enough, you just don't. But if you do, then you have to accept that they happen to everybody. Famous people's souls are just the same as everybody else's souls.
Exactly. And they've got issues the same as anybody else does, believe
me.
Oh,
yeah, golly. I mean, you can so see how Garth has worked around some of his issues to do with this past life. I mean, since I met him, he actually became divorced and has actually remarried the right person, you know? And I think that he became released to do that, because he had a certain amount of guilt from his life as Ryan. Again, as we said, totally unwarranted guilt and totally unnecessary, because when he was a boy in Ireland, he ended up being left as an orphan, really,
yes.
to look after his two sisters. And, you know, he was 12 years old. He couldn't do it. You know, they both died. And he kind of said right there and then, right, I'm never going to love anybody again. I'm never going to let anybody rely on me again. I'm going to be a free agent. You know, certainly I think some of that carried over into this life with him. But since we met, and I think since he's had some of the memories come back, you know, he has been able to not worry about how a divorce is going to look to his Bible Belt fan base.
Yes.
They've
got to wake up too, believe me. And I think,
yeah.
you know, I want to share something that I think is quite profound. For all of the events that led up to me moving to Nashville, and again, it was just so out of the blue. Mm-hmm. Who'd have thunk it in a way? Because I never would have imagined, I never even aspired to move to Nashville. What? Country music? Christians? No, thank you very much. I think I'll pass on that one. But yet, when I moved to Nashville, I mean, straight away, my landladies who owned the house or the flat, I lived upstairs in a two-family house, they were so loving and they embraced me. They welcomed me with a hug, and I just thought, oh, my God, something is going to be very special here.
Mm-hmm.
Straight away, things started falling into place. I made friends. I was very busy in my work. Here I was, you know, being a psychic and a healing practitioner in Nashville.
Yes.
Okay. As well as, you know, doing the music, because I'm a singer. I play keys and I do all of that as well. But things kept falling into place. I made lovely, lovely, good, loyal friends there. It was in Nashville that I had my coming out, as it were, as a near-death experiencer.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up on radio and television in Nashville talking about my near-death experiences. And that's also where I started my discussion and support group meetings. In Nashville.
I mean,
Yeah, as you say, who'd have thunk it years ago if somebody had told you you're going to start a support group for near-death experiences in Nashville? You'd have just laughed, wouldn't you?
I would have. I would have said, you're out of your bloody mind. But that's exactly what happened.
It's like me. I mean, I ended up hosting my own TV show for 2 years. And if somebody had told me I was going to do that, you know, it's ridiculous. It's just incredible how, you know, our guides can organise these things to happen. And you just, I mean, somebody said to me when I was aspiring to meet Garth, and I was saying, I just can't imagine how it's ever going to happen. A psychic friend of mine said, if they want it to happen, he'll walk down the street in the middle of Taunton in Somerset. You know, he just will. For some reason, if that's what's meant to happen, that's what will happen. So, you know, don't doubt that it will happen, because it will.
And that's another interesting point, too, because when I'm giving readings to people and I tell them about things that I see coming up for them, and they say, well, how could that happen? I don't have any money, or whatever it may be about. And I say, it doesn't matter how. You've got to trust that it will happen, and just pay attention, because you might hear a little voice in your head that guides you to do something or what have you.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, boom, there you are. And, you know, it's just, I mean, you completely overcame your fear of flying.
Yeah, that was bizarre.
Madeline just took over. And I remember in that story, boy, there was no stopping her or Ryan.
No.
They were powerful, courageous, dedicated beings. And I was just... And I remember as I was reading it, I thought, Bryony, this isn't a novel. This is a true story. And it just filled me with such joy, the perseverance, the unconditional love. And then also, unfortunately, the all-too-familiar rivalry of Margaret. Now, this brings me to another interesting question, because you told me in the email... And I don't even remember his brother's name. Is that Bob also, Garth's brother?
No, Kelly.
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 Okay. I think you said that you met him and that he didn't take well to you. Do I remember that correct?
He actually phoned me up. I didn't actually meet him in person. He actually phoned me up. And he was furious that I'd met Garth. And it was kind of strange, because he wanted me to stop everything I was doing. And he said a strange thing. He said to me, if you really are Madeline, you do what I'm telling you. And I found that a bit of a strange thing to say, because he was kind of trying to stop me. And the only reason for doing that was because presumably he didn't believe me. And yet he was using who I was saying I had been to try and persuade me to stop, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
It was very odd. I got very strange vibes from him. He wasn't at all pleasant. He literally was screaming down the phone at me. It was very strange. It was very, very strange. Because, you know,
that leads me to the question. It may, you know, when I read that in your email, I thought, I wonder if he is Margaret. Did that cross your mind?
It's crossed many people's minds.
Oh.
And I guess we'll never know. You know?
Well, we could know.
Well, we could know, but we can't prove it.
At the moment, we may not, but I just,
there are
I don't
some
know.
Very, yeah, there are some very strange things that have gone on, things that people in the media in Nashville have said to me. And, you know, Garth said a lot of things, not about his brother, but he said a lot of strange things that night, which I haven't repeated to anybody.
Right.
Because, you know, he can trust me. He did say stuff, but no, I've never told it to any media person. I will tell you quite a funny story, actually, but I think it's pretty funny. You remember I said that, I said I would if we had time. You remember I said that Graham, who put up the money for Ripples,
Yes.
You know, before, I was lucky enough then that attracted a proper publisher, and we were able to republish, and this time Souls Don't Lie, the whole story although it's still evolving as we speak. But
sure.
Graham said to me that he was putting up the money for love, and he said that he was also that he knew the story. Well, eventually, he was regressed before we went out to Nashville, because we wanted to know. He didn't really know what he meant by that, and we wanted to know what he meant by that. So he was regressed, and it was discovered that he was Ryan's best friend, and he was called Jared. And the thing about Jared was that he was a homosexual, which in those days was, you know, it wasn't really thought anything of. This is what makes me laugh. Normality changes, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Years, what's accepted isn't accepted. Anyway, I mean, at the time, the king was homosexual, so, you know, it was okay. And so, anyway, but that is an important part of the story. Now, Madeline never really knew Jared very well, but Ryan used to go drinking with him and stuff. And on the day of the wedding, and this was where Graham was regressed to, he was at the wedding when they got married.
That's what
wedding.
I remembered. Okay, yes, yes.
Yes. And he actually had been called away. He had to leave urgently because his sister was pregnant, and the family was in turmoil. And you see, this is the funny part about it. In those times, it was okay for him to be a homosexual, but it wasn't all right for his sister to get pregnant out of marriage. This is the daft way we human beings are. Anyway, now it's okay to get, you know, a few years ago it was okay to get pregnant but not to be a homosexual. Now it seems to be okay to do both. Thank goodness. But
yeah,
anyway, so he found out that as we left the church, Ryan had said to him, if anything happens to me, will you look after Madeline? And he swore that he would. And then he rode off. And he wasn't able to come back for 2 years. And when he did come back, they were both dead. Ryan had been abducted and killed, and Madeline had committed suicide because she didn't know what happened to him.
Yes.
And so, of course, he felt like he had really let down his friend. And when he said, this gave me goosebumps again, when he said he was doing it, when he said he was doing it for love, he meant that both he and I loved Ryan. So he was doing it for the love of Ryan, because he'd let him down in life, as he saw it. He was going to help me in this lifetime. So we met up with Garth, and Graham actually took that photograph that's on the front of Souls Don't Lie.
Okay.
And after he'd taken the photograph, he just stood there and he was smiling because he knew that this was what I'd wanted, you know, and how great it was. And Garth, who was still hugging me very tightly at the time, said to me, "Hey, Jenny," so I said, "Yes," he said, "Do you think Graham would like a little cuddle?"
Wow.
And it was like he was so obviously saying Graham is gay and would he like a cuddle with me as well. You know, you don't say that to a strange man you just met. You don't, and he made several kind of really heavy hints like that about Graham being gay, which he isn't, by the way. Not in this life. And, you know, of course, we realised he was recognising him as Jared, and so he was getting this gay persona from him because that was how he'd known him.
That
was a really bizarre thing that happened, and we really laughed about that.
Well, one comment that I would like to make, again, being the sensitive mm-hmm. that I am, often when I'm giving readings, especially for people whom I've never seen, most of the readings I do are remotely
mm-hmm.
via
better
telephone.
That way, isn't it?
In a lot of ways, yes, because people can just be in the comfort of their own space. They can be very relaxed and just very much who they are.
Mm.
And but I don't require photographs, but still when I see photographs, I read them.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw that the photograph on the front cover, and again, I had no idea who they were, and there was nothing anywhere inside the book that I could find that identified the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, is that Garth? And so I looked up online to look at his, to see what his Facebook was, and I thought, oh, blimey, it certainly is.
Mm.
And what I noticed straight away is that he's very, very present in the photograph.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's beaming. He's so happy. He's
his
so
eyes,
he
his eyes.
Oh, he's glowing, and there's nothing put on about that at all. And the same with you. I could see this is a very genuine, loving embracer.
Mm.
Wow. And that in itself is very, very telling. Mm. You know, you can't make up something like that. You just can't.
No.
And, you two obviously have got a very deep soul connection, which will continue. But every lifetime, as we know, you know, we take on different roles. And how interesting that he was the commoner, quote, or the guised aristocrat in the past life.
Yeah.
And then in this life, he became the full-blown famous entity.
Yes. And I think, you know, that Ryan was preparing him for that power that he has now.
I think so, absolutely.
And it's why he treats it with respect.
I was thinking about that also, and I think also how ironic that Garth is basically a skinhead now.
Yes, bless him.
And then he had beautiful flowing hair, you know, in that past life.
Well, this is what I was going to say to you about Chris Gaines, who you hadn't heard of, because Chris Gaines, actually the media started saying that Garth had totally lost it and gone bonkers, because what he did was he actually created this rock star character.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and dressed up in leather and black clothes and a long black wig to play the rock. And actually came on stage dressed up like that, singing songs as this other person. And the press couldn't understand it at all. But of course I could.
Yes.
Because as the story, as the memories of Ryan came out in me, and I wrote them down as a journal, as a book, in him, they came out in Chris Gaines. And numerology, which I know you're into, the two names, Ryan Fitzgerald and Chris Gaines, add up to the same base number. And Ryan's date of birth, which was recorded in my book, and Chris Gaines' date of birth, which Garth made up, both add up to the same base number in numerology. So, in fact, they are the same person.
That is quite
and actually,
stunning.
When you, yeah, and when you see photos of Chris Gaines on the cover of the CD, which have obviously been altered, they are exactly how the lady in Seattle used to alter his Garth pictures to look. She used to add long hair and narrow his face down and things like that. And
I tell you, when I look at him, I'd like to do the same thing, to be honest.
Well, you know, he's got a very wide jaw.
Yes, he does.
It's not that his face is fat. He's just got a very wide jaw. But he's got the most wonderful eyes, which, of course, are the part that I recognise, really.
And that's what we do recognise. In fact, comments that I have made, I think I wrote about this a number of years ago, that the two features, yes, I think it was because I was really appreciating reading Dr. Brian Weiss's book, Only Love is Real.
Yes.
True story, Only Love is Real indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I recognize souls is the eyes. And the hands.
Hands. I knew you were going to say hands.
See?
Because that's the same thing again. You know, I had weird stuff going on with hands. I used to get this, like, ghostly hand appear over mine.
Oh, that's right.
You know, and it was a long time before I could find a photo of his hands, of Garth's hands. And when we met, I kept staring at his hands because I was comparing, you know, how they were the same as I described them to be. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. Everything else changes, but not the hands and the eyes.
Exactly, and that's what I have found repeatedly to be true.
Mm.
It's quite remarkable, really.
Mm.
And the other thing too, you know, with Garth creating the so-called fictitious character,
mm.
I think it was actually coming from his soul remembering,
oh.
you know, if you want to call it the subconscious or what have you.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of this isn't going to be in the conscious mind, but the soul
doesn't lie.
Exactly,
yeah,
and it's always going to find a way to come forth. It's always going to find a way to come forth and to reveal itself. You know, as you were doing the automatic writing, or you just get a vision or a dream or hear words being said in your head. You know, and it's so interesting with these silly psychiatrists who say, oh, are you hearing voices? Oh, you're mad, we've got to lock you up. Well, excuse me, they're the ones who are quite mad.
Mm.
This is all memories that we are having, and,
mm.
you know, we've got a big job to turn all of these lies around and let people know, look, this is memory coming back to you.
Mm.
You're not mad. You've not lost it. You're remembering. And in fact, I think that right now as we speak, this is happening globally in a huge, huge way.
Mm.
There's an awakening, a quickening going on. People are starting to remember who they are and becoming more authentic, including Garth. And so that makes me think that a lot of people who are well known, and I don't like to use the word celebrity, I just don't like that word, that, you know, as they start to remember who they are, I think that they are becoming less and less tolerant of the games, of the pretentiousness that their managers and agents and publicists put on, what I call their prison wardens, because they build this huge wall between this individual and the masses, and they want to say, wait a minute, they're people.
Yes, and they miss so much. They miss so much because people can't reach them. And sometimes, you know, sometimes these people may have information they want or need, but they can't reach them.
Because
and
of these
I understand,
people building these huge walls.
Yes, that's right. I understand that they've got to be protected, you know, to a certain
to a
extent.
Point. Mm.
But don't cut them off from the real world entirely.
Exactly. And I'm also thinking, wouldn't it be ironic if Margaret, who was just hell-bent on getting rid of Ryan, ends up being his brother in this life? It just, I don't know, that would be very interesting. And
it
when I
be,
get
yes.
into trance, I'll see what I get, and I'm certainly happy to report this back to you. And
I'd be fascinated. Yes, do let me know.
I'm
too close, really, and I don't think I could be objective enough about it to look into it myself. So it'd be really good if you could do that.
I'd be pleased to, and at the same time, still be open to the fact that it could still come to you because, you know, Jared came back to you, and so did... I don't remember Ryan's brother's name in that life, but you know, people are still coming to you who actually did have these direct connections in this past life. Now, something I'm curious about, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, would you say that this was your most recent past life, do you think? Or do you know?
No, I think I had one in the Second World War. Because I was always, ever since I can remember in this lifetime, I've been terrified of hot air balloons or zeppelins, airships, things like that. Absolutely terrified of them. If one comes across where we live, you know, I'd have to run indoors. I couldn't stay out there and have it come over the top of me. And my mum and dad swore that I never saw the Hindenburg crash or anything like that, because that was before I was born, and they say I never did. And I'm also very, very easily startled by loud noises.
Me too.
Very easily. Right, and so yes, I think that I had a life in the Second World War. I also know of one I had in the 1700s where I was actually a Down syndrome man called Patrick. I've never actually gone into a lot of research on this, on that particular item. I have on several others that were earlier. But the thing about Patrick, and one day perhaps somebody will confirm this for me, Patrick was Irish, but he actually had been sent to live in a monastery in Italy at quite a young age. I assume it was because it was a choice between that or having him institutionalised, which his parents didn't want to do. So that was a very strange experience. And I did some, I think they call it scrying, when you use a mirror.
Yes.
And there is a method by which you can actually see yourself in your past life. And I've actually been able to do that with Patrick, you know, and actually look in the mirror and see my features change into the classic Down syndrome type face, boy's face, which is quite strange. I mean, I have had another one where I was a 10-year-old boy, and that was, I had a flashback to that one. The first inkling I had of that one was I was getting into the bath one day. You'll laugh, because as I lowered myself into the water, which was a little bit hot, I had the absolutely genuine sensation of male genitalia shrinking up from the hot water. And I straight away had a flashback of when I was caught stealing food from a kitchen. I was actually grabbed and shoved into a hot bath, you know, because I was filthy for a start. And I can actually, you know, that actually triggered the flashback. And it's pretty strange when that happens to you and your body actually changes.
Yes, yes. I've had experiences like that as well. And you know, again, I think these are wonderful details to bring up to help enable people to be aware and to pay attention to all of this kind of stuff. Because, you know, obviously we are reacting to traumas that have happened in previous lives as well as traumas that may have happened in this one.
Mm.
And I've met a number of people. That's interesting how a number of people did Paris for whatever reason during World War II and turned around and came right back into this plane. I was born during World War II. And I remember just feeling straight away, oh my goodness me, this isn't where I belong. You know, I straight away felt so alien, still do, as a matter of fact, to this world and to this plane. It just all has always felt wrong to me because of the lack of love here. And yet the work, and I feel very, very strong about this, that I'm just one of those like yourself who's come here to and been sent back after the near-death experiences to plant these seeds to help everyone to remember again who they are as multi-dimensional beings and as divine sparks rather than, you know, what the religions would teach. And it's, you know, to me, I regard that mostly as a mind prison. That doesn't mean that there are not people who are not totally sincere within their religious frame of mind, but at the same time, they're so centered in fear.
Absolutely.
What you're doing is really a marvelous, marvelous tool for waking people up.
It can be a difficult life, though, sometimes, can't it? If, like you say, you've come from a place of love, a place of rapture, really.
Yes.
And been sort of plunged into the harsh realities of mortality. It can be quite difficult sometimes. And something occurred to me just now I wanted to mention that...
please.
You know, we were talking about synchronicity and all the people that you've come close to meeting Garth Brooks yourself, or, you know, how bizarre that is. I was actually on a train once in Ireland, driving, it's like a coastal train that runs down the the east coast of Ireland. It's rather lovely, actually.
Oh, yes, I was thinking.
And there's this young lady sitting opposite us. And after a while, she leaned forward and she said, "I'm sorry to interrupt and sound like I'm eavesdropping," she said, "but I heard you mention Garth Brooks." She said, "My cousin works in his office."
Oh, goodness me.
In Nashville. Yeah, I mean, how bizarre is that?
Wow, yeah.
That is just totally ridiculous, and that kind of is the way it's gone on. I mean, Garth himself must find it a bit odd, because quite often he meets mention me to him, and that I think sometimes they do it just to see his reaction, and they're always quite stunned. I mean, he must wonder what's going on, because there was a guy who did a sports radio program, Mark Lewis, who used to do an esoteric one before that, and I'd been on his program, and he did an interview with Garth when he was playing baseball. And at the end of the interview, he said to him, "Oh, by the way, I know somebody who you know in England, a lady called Jenny Smedley."
Wow.
And then there was this German singer-songwriter, Frank, who went over to America and managed to meet Garth, and said to him, "Oh, by the way, a lady called Jenny Smedley asked me to give you a because I..." You know, Frank was amazed, because he said it didn't take a heartbeat before Garth said, "Oh, you mean the lady who wrote Ripples? I met her."
Oh, that is so lovely.
So it kind of works both ways, you know, to an extent. But I do think that the only sad part about that meeting with him was right at the end of the meeting, he said that he'd like my phone number. Because he said he wanted to read the book properly, and then he would give me a call. And he said, "It might take me some time, because I'm a bit slow at this sort of thing, but I will get it read, and I will call you." But he never has. And you have to wonder, because the next person I spoke to on the phone was his brother. I told you about that conversation.
Oh, yes.
You know, you feel that... you can imagine the conversation, can't you, really?
Yes.
"Why did you talk to her? She might go to the papers, you know. Are you mad? You can't phone her. Whatever you say, she might take that to the papers, you know." So I've just gone on in my merry way, and people occasionally mention me to him, and I hope one day, you know, he will live up to his promise. Because, you know, I've proven over and over again that I can be trusted.
Absolutely, and I think too that as I've been you know, reading your book and just feeling such a, I mean, it's even come into my dreams. You know, I feel myself merged in the circle myself. It's just, mm-hmm. There's something to all of this, even involving me. You know,
right?
And,
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Yes, and I was feeling really strongly. I said, they're not done yet, and I really feel that you will hear from him, and that something is going to happen. And another interesting point about this too is that you know, you were talking about some of the events that were very similar, you know, like how he, as Ryan, saved people from a fire, and then that he actually, in this life, saved a child named Ryan from dying in a fire in Oklahoma, I believe you said.
Yes.
And something that I want to say about this is that I feel that, you know, even though he may be dealing with opposition, and I'm just going to conclude that this is Margaret he's dealing with.
Okay.
Yeah. That, because let's face it, Ryan could not be daunted. He was totally undaunted throughout that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, funnily enough, I feel in some ways he's become a little bit weaker in this life.
Yeah.
All right, as far as honoring his convictions, he's just not that strong a being. But I feel like something, you know, because This isn't only for you, Lovey. It's also for him. It's to help him awaken and to grow. And I think that this somehow is going to compel him to renew that audacity and that inner strength of character to become truly authentic and to honor the calling of his soul. So, yes, I really firmly am getting that you will hear from him. And indeed, he must contact you because this is something bigger than anybody's ego. Mm. I promise you that one.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, funnily enough, I continue to be haunted by Nashville. You know, my mobile is still my Nashville phone number. Mm. You know, I'm constantly in touch with my friends down there. And I've got people who want me to go back there. So who knows that I could end up taking a trip back. And what interesting things could unfold if and when that does happen. But
well, it would be quite funny, wouldn't it, if you went back there one day and turned around and there he was standing behind you.
Yes. Yes.
That'd have to be meant then, wouldn't it, if that happened?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I experienced so much synchronicity when I was in Nashville. And, you know, I was unbeknownst to me because, again, I don't even know country music. I don't know country music artists. And here I was jamming with them, not even being aware of it. We did these acoustic circles in Franklin where, you know, in that area a lot of them live, and I sing harmony. And so I would just start piping in with all of this harmony, just singing harmony with people on the fly, and they would turn their heads and go, oh, my God, listen to this. And I just loved it. It just made me high. Talk about making me really, really high. It's just doing the music. I love singing harmony. And so when people are singing together in harmony and something that's really melodic, I find that very beautiful. But one thing that I did notice when I was there is that there were a number of people, again, in the biz, who were aware of past lives, who were NDEers, who, you know, just had all of these experiences that they were starting to just come out with it and say, yes, in fact, I have been through these experiences. And I think a big part of my work is to help remove this stigma around all of this.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I think you're right, too. I mean, because Willie Nelson is probably the most famous country music artist who firmly believe in past lives. In fact, he did a song with Johnny Cash called The Highwayman, which it was only, it's quite an old song, but it was only sort of quite recently, really, that listening to the words, my husband and I realised that it is about reincarnation. He's saying, I might come back as a highwayman, you know, and saying who he's been before.
Yeah.
So,
you
know, to make that song, I guess Johnny Cash did as well. So, yeah, who knows?
And I was in the circle of people who knew Johnny, and in fact I was I'm trying to remember. Oh, I think it was after Chet's funeral. It was interesting because when I was there, some musicians that I knew, including my singing partner that I was with at the time, her brother transitioned, and our drummer transitioned. And what was interesting with our drummer is that he came from a mafia family.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also in the Vietnam War, and he would just stealthily take people off and straight away kill them without a weapon or anything. He knew how to strangle them or something. And then he decided, I don't want to do anything like this. I'm going to turn to making music.
Yeah.
And so he went from New Jersey and New York City to Nashville. And he transitioned whilst I was living in Nashville. So it was interesting that a lot of people that I knew and worked with, as well as people that I only knew indirectly, transitioned, but I was so aware of their spirits. And they spoke to me from the other side. And I'll give you an example. Roger Martin was my singing partner. Her name was Terry Lynn. Roger Martin, her brother, he sang blues and played and all of this stuff. And he crossed over, and we were going to go to his funeral and memorial. And his dear friend and my friend producer, Mike Dunbar, was going to you know, facilitate the funeral, and all night long, God blame, I could not sleep, and I was so aware of Roger all around me, and I kept getting the song, Just My Broom, Just My Broom. Well, it's a blues song. And so the next day, Mike was saying, well, I'm trying to figure out what song to do at the funeral for Roger. And I said, Just My Broom. Roger's been nagging me all night long with the song, Just My Broom. And Mike said, well, did you know, Juliet, that Just My Broom was Roger's signature song?
Oh.
So he did Just My Broom at the funeral, and then meanwhile, Roger's body had been cremated, and they were holding up the urn, and everybody was looking at the urn. Meanwhile, my eye was distracted and pulled way over to the left where there was this empty floor space. And he said, I'm not in that urn. I'm over here dancing. And I could see Roger clear as day dancing away. And I thought, oh, mate, you're free. You're having a jolly time, aren't you? And I described that to Mike and to Terry. Then I did drawings of Roger because I only met Roger after he was ill. What had happened was that he had had a heart transplant.
Right.
People typically only last 2 to 2.5 years, and he actually crossed over 2.5 years after the transplant. So I was doing drawings of what I perceived that he had looked like before he became ill, and Roger and Terry Lynn told me exactly that that's exactly what he looked like.
Wow.
And I did pictures of him in the recording studio, all of this stuff, describing the clothes that he wore, and they said that's exactly what he was like.
Wow.
So,
because you realize that Garth was there.
Yes.
At the funeral. He must have been.
Probably.
But at the time, you didn't know what he looked like.
Well, I had an idea what he looked like because I remembered a round face and a big round hat to match.
Mm-hmm.
But again, being visually impaired, I can't see people unless they're pretty much right in front of me, you know?
Right.
But
that's strange to think, isn't it?
Yes.
You may have stood next to him or...
I could very well have done, maybe we will cross paths.
I've got a feeling you will. I've got a feeling you're some kind of catalyst here.
Well, that's my middle name, my dear, I tell you. That is the story of my life, I kid you not. And in fact, I'm sure my daughter would be grinning and smiling here in that one. Because that is what I do, and I really, like it or not, I kind of, in a very loving way, shake things up. And
that's what we need. We could do a bit of shaking things up.
Yes. And there was nothing lightweight, as it were, about what I experienced, you know. And I weigh only 8 stone or maybe less at this point. And in fact, I connect with some very profound people. For example, David Icke, who I found out about him when I was in Nashville. Somebody literally came up to me, put his book in my hand, and said, "You've got to read this."
I actually had David Icke twice on my TV show.
Oh, he's such a
another coincidence.
Well, coincidence, as I like to call it, because there's no such thing as chance.
No.
But when we use the word as coincidence, it's more like
coincidence,
saying
yes.
Synchronizing, you know.
But he's a very nice guy and somewhat misunderstood, I think.
Very
in
much
some circles.
So. And his eyes are very clear and very loving and he's very consistent. I love the man. And what's interesting is I was telling my daughter about him because my daughter lives in Boston and she'd come visit me in Nashville. And I said, this man is remarkable. And she said, Mum, I think you're destined to connect with him. Indeed, we have done.
Oh.
And I told David, I said, you're like family to me, lad. And he really is. There's a deep truth there. And then other wonderful people. Again, Nashville connections, Kathy O'Brien and Mark Phillips. And straight away acknowledging this deep soul connection. So that's why I said, you know, doing this work, being in Nashville, doing this radio show, has connected me with the most beautiful, wonderful people and kindred spirits indeed, and it's nothing to be overlooked. It is something very, very important, very significant that we all need to pay attention to. But,
absolutely.
And it's so strange feeling the energy of Margaret, because I've dealt with a number of Margarets in my life, and this one as well as in past ones. And it seems to me, because they are just so permeated with fear, with hatred.
Hatred
is a byproduct of fear.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit, you know, there was that phone call, there was no cause for him to react as aggressively as he did.
Exactly.
It was like, you know, ridiculous. It was really ridiculous.
And I think they take, you know, they can take quite a time to, how do you say, to recover or to burn out the fear. In fact, when I was on the other side, I remember seeing these sort of great faceless entities, these people who had just been so full of fear and loathing and you know, doing all of these atrocities during their physical incarnations. And I regard them as having gone retrograde, you know, they kind of go backwards for a while, and then ultimately they will heal from that, you know, they'll realize it's not real, it's just that they've been truly blinded to what truth is.
Mm.
And, you know, and I've seen a number of these people, as I said, who are either, you know, family members or more commonly, like arranged marriages or managers or agents, as I call the prison wardens, because they really are so blinded, they can't even fathom what it is to know love.
That's right.
And another thing too is that you're quite sane and you're quite sound and you're quite sober and you don't act like a delusional fan, and believe me, I've met them.
There are some funny people out there. I mean, I have come up against a few who simply couldn't handle my story at all, you know, just because he's theirs, he belongs to them.
Oh dear.
You know, and one woman in particular sort of did a one man hate campaign about me, spreading all kinds of stories around the internet. And it's unfortunate, you know, because the internet can be a marvelous spiritual tool.
It really
can. But unfortunately, it can also be abused by people, you know, because they can put something out there for everyone to see.
Yeah.
And, you know, a proportion of people will believe it, which is a great shame, I think.
It is, but I think the good news is that their nonsense is going to be washed away. And, you know, just the fact that you and I have connected, there's another link in this beautiful, what I regard as a sacred story here. And this has just been so tremendous. And as I figured, we filled up these 2 hours very beautifully.
Gosh.
We've come to the end of this transmission of Toward the Light. It's just been so wonderful having you on the show, Jenny. It's tremendous, and we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, that'd be great. And don't forget, I'm going to have your story out here in magazines. We get more listeners, even more listeners to your program. And, you know, you really have got to do a book. I'm sure your listeners will agree. You really need to do a book.
Oh, well, I'm going to work on that for sure, my dear. Certainly I will do. And thank you so much for being with us. Everybody, you've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale reminding you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. Next week, we will have Derek White Sky Cloud on our show, so look forward to listening to him on our show next week. Please join us for another transmission of Toward the Light. Blessings and light to all.